As you probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code The Athletic. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Today's episode of The Athletic Support is brought to you by Remarkably Remote, a new daily microcast from the experts at GoToMeeting, all about making work from home work for you. With indisputable intel on how to stay sane, motivated, and productive at home, we're here to help you in this brave new remote working world. Find us on smart speakers or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. You can also listen at gotomeeting.com/tips. That's gotomeeting.com/tips.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by The Athletic. I am Marc-Antoine Godin. And as usual, I am with my partner, longtime friend, Arpin Basu. Hello, Arpin. How are you?
I'm doing well in confinement, Marc-Antoine. My family and I are trudging along, finding new and interesting ways to keep ourselves busy. But it's fun. And it's fun to talk to you. I don't get to talk to you nearly as often as I usually do.
That's true, and I don't get to see you as nearly as we usually do, but that's all right. That's all right. Yesterday I showed my daughter where you lived.
Oh, really? Okay,
that's good. during my afternoon walk. That's as far as close as I got to your place. Listen, on this beautiful Friday, April 17th, we have the luxury of having an amazing guest with us today, no other than Craig Button, who's with us today. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Marc-Antoine. Hello, Arpan.
Well, so how are you, sir?
I am really good. And, you know, we talked about, you know, isolation and confinement. You know, I'm out in Calgary and this is, we've had some fantastic snow and it's always a good time to want to go out and ski because the sun is warm and the days on the slopes are warm. Can't do that. They've closed the gates. They've closed the hills. So we're all missing something.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, but I feel it is a good time to sort of reflect on some things. But as far as we're concerned, we're reflecting on sort of some big picture, hockey issues, regarding the Canadiens. And I think that, you know, I want to get started with you on talking about a name that has a lot of people in Montreal excited and is also a bit of a mystery to a lot of people in Montreal just because of, you know, his limited usage in the KHL, but his outstanding performances at the World Juniors, and that's Alexander Romanov. You have been outwardly enthusiastic about this kid. I just wonder what it is about him that gets you so excited as a player.
Well, you know, when you watch Alexander play, he's not a bystander in the game. He's not waiting for the game to come to him. He wants to grab the game and make a difference. And, you know, when you're a younger player and you're trying to move into pro hockey, whether it be the KHL or the NHL, you know, sometimes you have to harness that enthusiasm and that energy. And I have no doubt in my mind that Alexander is going to be able to do that. But, and you know, Arpan, you talk about limited use, but he played almost 12 minutes a game on average as an 18-year-old in the KHL. Mm-hmm. I can tell you about the KHL. They don't even know the names of 18-year-old defensemen, let alone put them in a lineup and play them a little less than 12 minutes a game. And so for him to do that, and then he took another step this year playing in the, on a good team, and he's learning. But when you watch him move out of that environment into his own age group with the junior team, I mean, he's a bold player that takes the initiative. And, you know, I don't think that Alexander's going to be an elite offensive player. I don't think he's going to be solely just a defensive player, but I think he's going to be an incredibly important player because he plays the game. He's so aware of what's happening in the game, and he's ready to react, and he's ready to take advantage. And he's got the skills, he's got the competitive nature to his game, and he's got the real sense and feel to make those differences. And you know, when you think about somebody that can come into your lineup and contribute in a lot of different ways, and you manage those expectations correctly, I think they have the makings of, I don't think he's a number one defenseman, but mm-hmm. I think he can be a top pair defenseman and certainly no less than a number three defenseman.
Hmm. Wow. That's pretty good. But Arpan was mentioning the ice time though. This year it seems as though his ice time has gone down. I think that's the part that seems to puzzle a lot of fans, a lot of people in Montreal. We asked a question the other day to Trevor Timmins, and honestly, he didn't have a satisfying answer for us in that regard. So I wonder sometimes, is it because his team had a feeling that he was ready to leave and to join Montreal, and they were going about it like, you know, okay, you want to leave us at some point? Well, why don't you sit down and think about it a little bit more? And they would just reduce his usage. I don't know exactly what happened there. And I wonder if you would have a valuable explanation for us.
Well, here's what I would say. I would say in the evolution of Alexander, you know, he's confident. And now he gains even more confidence after last year. And we see that with players at different levels. But as you move into pro hockey, and sometimes you gotta put the reins on a player a little bit more, and you gotta make him earn it a little bit more. And you're not as forgiving of his mistakes as you were when he was 18, and you're expecting him to learn. And I think those were all, areas where it's a learning curve for Alexander, and it's understanding that, okay, you know what? They're going to hold me accountable for this because our team is good. And I think when you're on a really good team and the Red Army and CSKA is a really good team, I think that what really helps them is that they do hold them accountable. Young defensemen, and Jacques Laperriere told me this many, many years ago. You know, you're always kind of developing. You're an understudy, even if you're playing in the NHL. But what defensemen have to learn as they move up the ranks and into the NHL, they have to learn what they can't do. We know what they can do. That's what gets them drafted. But they have to learn what they can't do any longer, or they'll be taken advantage of. And I think that that's where Alexander is on the development curve. And I think it's really important that teams are in the developmental area are going to hold players accountable. And just because you're a good prospect, they're not going to just keep throwing you out there. If you're not contributing to the team, you know what? You're not going to get as much ice time, and you need to learn. And I think that, you know, the KHL and CSKA, they're not going to hold a player back if he can help them, but they're not going to just reward him if he's not doing the things that he needs to do. So I don't think they're trying to hold Alexander back. They want their players to have success not only with them, but if they move over to the NHL. So I think this is just about the growth of Alexander. And I think he's fortunate, and Montreal Canadiens should be fortunate too, that he's in a developmental environment where they will hold him accountable.
Yeah, that's actually, I hadn't thought of it that way. You know, I kind of took Trevor's explanation to mean that, you know, they just didn't want to invest in his development necessarily as much as a team would if they knew they were going to have him for multiple years. But I think that's actually a really good point that you raise. And I was on the radio yesterday with Mitch Melnick and he mentioned, Darius Kasparaitis as a sort of, is that the style of player that we could expect to see from him? Is that, you know, I don't know if that's just because he's Russian or whatever, but I mean, is that a fair comparison or is that a fair sort of idea of his mindset when it comes to playing physically and what have you?
Well, I think it's I would use the word robust, right. You know, like Darius played a robust game. And I think that the comparison to Alexander is a good one. You know, I've gone back in time. And I've gone way back and, you know, you both remember Guy Lapointe playing for the Montreal Canadiens. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Guy's a Hall of Famer, but that enthusiasm that Guy played with, you know, not just on the ice, but as a person. And I think that that's what I see in Alexander. And I know Guy very well. And actually I know Darius pretty well and I knew him from a young age. Darius, I think became this really good physical presence on the ice and it was more of a proving grounds. I'm not the biggest guy, but I'm going to take on the biggest guy. Mm-hmm. And you love that about Darius. And Alexander has that same kind of mentality. Like, give me the biggest challenge. I'm taking it on and I'm not going to shrink. I'm not going to take a step back. So in that regard, I could see that comparison certainly, with respect to, Romanov and Kasparaitis.
I wanted to ask you before we move on to regarding not necessarily Romanov himself, but one of his teammate with the Red Army. The Canadians had shown interest in Konstantin Okolov, and he's a player who was rumored to be leaving the KHL and coming to Montreal, or either to Montreal or to Toronto. They were labeled as the two front runners for his services. And he decided to not move to North America and stay in the KHL at least for one more year. And I saw other Russian players also deciding to get new contracts in Russia instead of making the move to North America. Whereas at first it seemed as though there would have been an exodus of Russian players trying their way to North America. So do you think that the Okolov deciding not to sign either with Toronto or Montreal is a part of a bigger trend of Russian players that choose to stay in Russia at least for the time being?
Well, you know, Mark, I think that you know, one of the things that the KHL is trying to implement is a salary cap, and we've already seen some teams that are. One team that isn't coming back next year, other teams that are, you know, considering if they can come back and play in the KHL. So that shrinks your player pool. But what it never does, it never shrinks your player pool for the top players. So Slepyshov's a top player in the KHL, a really good player. He's one of your upper players. You know, Okolov is a really good player. So what the KHL does is they say, well, we don't want to lose our good players, so we're going to pay them more. And this is one of the challenges for Okolov is that because he has to come over on an entry-level contract, he's limited to what he can get. I mean, he can get bonuses and everything like that. But they're saying, we got this guaranteed for you, and we're going to pay you. And the other part of it, too, and it's a reality, is you get a little bit older, and Okolov might have, like, he has all this interest, as he should. I mean, he looks like a player that could come over to the NHL and contribute. But at the same time, you know, you're comfortable, you know, you're getting paid, your family, and there's a lot of other factors, you know, that are personal that come into play. And then you also have the league saying, listen, we don't want to lose our good players. And certainly he is one of those good players, and, you know, they're able to pay him more. So that becomes another factor in a player's decision. And I wouldn't call it reluctance, but it's just, okay, here's what we have. You're being seduced by the team that you have. You're being seduced by an NHL team. And then there's other factors that come into play. And I think all those factors contribute to the decision. And whether it be Barabanov coming and signing with the Toronto Maple Leafs or Okolov not coming over, Slepyshev not coming over to the Edmonton Oilers, I think it's all these factors that are playing a part in the ultimate decision.
Right. And I guess that the financial landscape is changing because of the pandemic. So it might change the way NHL teams are approaching free agents too. So I guess that also comes into play.
Well, it does. And, you know, one of the things that the KHL did, you know, and they wanted to keep their young players at home. And so they were able to pay them a lot more. You know, you got a young player that's not ready for the NHL and he can make a lot more than his minor league salary in the American Hockey League. So that was a way to keep them. But if they're going to introduce a salary cap now, you know, they're going to be limited in what they're going to be able to pay those young players. And they're not going to want to pay those young players because they're not quite ready to play. They're not ready to play a prominent role. So more of the money in the salary cap is going to go to more established players. So that's going to play a factor, you know, in going forward here, you know, in terms of Russian players. And, you know, might switch now where you might have a better chance to get the younger players over here because they're not going to be able to get paid as much because of the salary cap. And of course, I mean, the pandemic has created a lot of uncertainties and unknowns for everybody in the hockey world.
Yeah, of course it has. And it's actually interesting. We spoke to Ben Chiarot yesterday and he was just talking about free agents and how, you know, how, what bad timing it is for free agents right now to be hitting this one chance in your life, in your whole career to hit it big. And then this happens. It's you know, obviously perspective is needed when we're talking about this, but it is sort of an unfortunate thing, going on there. I just wanted to move on with the Canadiens prospects. Obviously what are some of the bigger news that's happened since the NHL, got shut down was the Canadiens decision, or I guess the mutual decision to a certain extent, between the Canadiens and Cole Caufield to have him go back to the University of Wisconsin next season. And I wanted to get your take on that just because, you know, I think for some of the higher end prospects that go to college, and you saw, you know, his teammate Alex Turcotte who signed with the Kings, you know, Keandre Miller went back for a second year, but he wound up signing with the Rangers. But it's curious today to see a player have a freshman season like Cole Caufield had and have him go back, and just the circumstances surrounding the public nature of that decision and I guess some communication gaps between the Canadiens and their prospects. What was your take on all that when you saw it sort of unfolding?
Well, if I go back in time, and I know Cole pretty well, you know, that group of players that played in the 2001 borns that played in that USA program, from Hughes to Turcotte to Caufield to Boldy to Zegras, you know, we know who they are.
Sure.
Now, they're an extremely confident group, and they were an extremely successful group. So, you know, because they had so much success at 16 and 17 and then even into college, you know, a lot of them think that they're ready. And I will tell you this, the NHL is not a development league, and the NHL, if you're not ready, it's going to eat you up real quick. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Cole Caufield to me is a terrific goal scorer, but Cole Caufield's got to continue to prepare himself physically, mentally, to be able to perform at the National League level. I mean, he tied for the freshman lead in goals with Alex Newhook at Boston College. Mm-hmm. So he's shown a real capability. But, you know, keep building on that. Keep building on that. Where I think there's a really great opportunity for him to grow physically and mature physically and to continue to gain that confidence. Because, you know, you start to go without scoring and you start to be less productive as time goes on, it becomes harder and harder to find it. I call it the Tyson Jost syndrome.
Yeah.
Tyson Jost was the 10th overall pick by the Colorado Avalanche. You know, moves along, goes to North Dakota. And if you go look at Tyson's numbers as a freshman, they were really good, better than Alex Turcotte. And Tyson, who had taken his time trying to mature, he decides he's going to turn pro. Now, he decides he's going to turn pro. The team wants him to turn pro. Okay, so you come to that conclusion. This past March or February at the trade deadline, there was lots of rumors circulating about Tyson Jost being available. Now, his teammate, when Tyson was a freshman, he played with Brock Besser. And Brock Besser had been a great freshman. Mm-hmm. And then he became an outstanding sophomore. Now what does he do? He steps right into the NHL and he's ready to do it. Tyson Jost was not ready to step into the NHL. And I know there's a debate about the American Hockey League as opposed to college. And I know the American League is becoming younger and younger. But from a place of where you're amongst your peers, not just in the classroom, but on campus with other players that are the same age, that changes significantly when you move into the AHL. Because there's three tiers of players in the AHL. The older, more experienced players. Mm. The players that are in that middle, they're still fighting to try to find a way into the NHL. And then the young guys. Mm. That's a really hard league to play in. So for me, looking at Cole and looking where he's at, like, I think he's in a great spot to continue that development. And quite frankly, and I've said it publicly, I think Alex Turcotte made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And I think the LA Kings made a mistake. And I've said it publicly, and I'm not afraid to say it, and I have my reasons for saying it. And if I'm wrong, I'll be the first one to admit I'm wrong. But I think it's a mistake, because I say the same thing. It's the Tyson Jost syndrome. It's the Curtis Lazar syndrome. If that's what you want to do when you're a high pick, you better be ready, because if you're not ready, you're in big trouble.
What are the factors that come into play for you compare Tyson Jost and Brock Besser? One was ready for the NHL, the other one was not. But where's the key of having like this self-evaluation to identify if you're ready or not? Does it come from the player? Is it coming from his surrounding, his coaches, his family advisor, his family, or what are the factors that come into play? Because it must be a difficult decision, because the player who wants to reach his dream, he'll hope that he can get to the NHL as soon as possible. So it must be a difficult line to manage.
It is, Mark, and I'm not trying to say that it's easy or not. What I try to use as a benchmark, and I've always tried to use it, and I've dealt with college players when I was working in the NHL, and now the young players, you know, I get asked lots of different questions by a lot of different people. I ask the question, have you dominated at your age group? Have you dominated at the level you're at? Have you dominated? And you know what? So, because if you haven't dominated at your level of play, what makes you think you're going to go to the NHL and contribute? It doesn't translate. And I love Tyson Jost, but I think he made a mistake leaving. I said it at the time. Big mistake. So Brock Besser dominates as a freshman. He doesn't leave. He comes back. He had a wrist injury, but he still was a dominant player, and he was stronger, not just physically, but mentally. Because the NHL, as both of you know, it's a really challenging environment, the day in, day out, holding your spot. And you have to be able to handle that. So I really try to look at players. I mean, we can look at physical maturity, Mark, and we can say, okay, the player understands. If you haven't dominated at the level you're at, I don't know why you think you're going to go to the National Hockey League and have success. I have no idea why you think that.
Yeah, there's an element of asset management here too. I mean, you look at Alex Turcotte, for instance, and you know, it's fair for you to think that he made a mistake, and I guess we'll find out. But I mean, when you look at the Kings situation, like when I saw that he was signing, I was really curious as to why they were in such a rush to sign him, because they're nowhere close to competing for a playoff spot. He's going to be in an environment where there's going to be a fair bit of losing going on. You know, you would think, unless they make some vast improvements before next season, and that has its own mental challenges and hurdles, I guess, for a young player. And so it just seems like, so in the Canadians' case with Caulfield, like, I think that they legitimately, from a hockey standpoint, wanted him to go back and do exactly what you're describing and dominate. But if you look at sort of staggering entry-level contracts and sort of making sure that there's money available for different people in different years, like, there's so many factors that go into it that I think a lot of people don't realize. And, you know, in Turcotte's case, it's just, from the Kings' point of view, you know, I found it hard to understand what other factors could have led them to make that decision other than they just want to get him as soon as possible. But there are, you know, sort of financial considerations and planning considerations that go into it when making a decision like that.
Absolutely, they are. And your points are excellent. And how you manage that over time, because you don't want all your young players coming up at the same time. And, you know, because that's going to create some challenges for you with salary on the salary cap. But, you know, the other thing, too, and I'll share this with you guys. When the U.S. lost to Finland in the quarterfinal at the World Junior Championships, I was right down there after in the post game zone, and watching Alex and Cole come out there, they were crushed, because these are two players amongst others in that group that I talk about that were so used to having success. And not only did the team not have success, but Alex and Cole didn't have that individual success, and they were crushed. And I wanted to, because, you know, in the international hockey, you know, the zone where you interview is for, I wanted to just put my arms around both of them and hug them. Because yeah. I knew how much they were hurting. I knew how much they were hurting, right? And so, you know, again, when you talk about LA and I talk about trying to develop, right? Like, you know, it doesn't become, like, if you're not ready to play and you're not ready to contribute like Alex and Cole have been, it becomes even that much harder in a mental standpoint to be able to go through that and not feeling that success. And so that's why I feel that way about Alex and Cole. And I feel mm-hmm. the exact same way about Trevor Zegras, who left to sign with Anaheim. Yeah. I don't feel any different about the three kids. So it doesn't mean, like I said, like I understand if you hate school, don't stay in school, you might end up in junior. But that's the rationale that I have when I evaluate those kids, because I know how much they want to make a difference. They're not just interested in getting an NHL salary or saying they signed. They want to be real difference makers in the game, and I know how much it bothers them and how much it affects them when they aren't.
I just want to follow up on that real quick. When you say, because I've talked to Cole about, on a couple of occasions, about his performance at the World Juniors, which obviously did not go well, and he doesn't sugarcoat that, but he has seemingly in his mind rationalized it in terms of how he was used, the minutes he got, the teammates, the guys he was playing with, the role he was playing. He seems to have, that seems to be the reasoning in his mind as to why that tournament worked out the way it did. And I think it's not, he's a young kid and what have you, but I'm struggling with understanding if that's a good thing. Like if you do anything you can to maintain your confidence and not own it, or is it better to own it? And I don't know what the answer is to that.
Here's what I think about Cole too. I thought as the tournament went on, And certainly Scott Sandlin would be one to tell you that he got a lot more comfortable with who he needed certain players to play with. I thought that Cole got better. But that being said, I think part of learning and growing is recognizing, okay, what do I need to take responsibility for? What was something that, you know, maybe wasn't fully my responsibility, but I could have done better? And what isn't my responsibility? You know, too much of the time, oh yeah, I could have done, like, you know, if you've done everything you can and you didn't win, it doesn't mean it's all your fault. And I think that's part of growth. I think that speaks to Cole having that emotional and mental maturity to understand, okay, here's what happened. Here's where I could have been better, but here's some things that affected, you know, my overall play. And now what you hope is that he applies those things and understands, okay, here's what I got to do if I end up in that situation again. The other thing for Cole, he's never been in that spot. He was always the frontline guy. He was always the go-to guy, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, adjusting to that and, you know, if Cole now takes it and says, hey, listen, you know what? I'm not going to be the frontline guy, but I got to contribute from this area in the lineup with this many minutes, you know, then he's grown. If he doesn't recognize that and he makes excuses and says, well, I don't have the frontline minutes, therefore you can't expect me to produce, that would raise some concerns on my end. But knowing Cole, I don't think that's the way he is.
No, that's not, and that's just to be clear, that's not what he said, but he did say,
no,
that
I know.
There's an adjustment that he needed to make that maybe he wasn't able to recognize soon enough. I think that's really how he, and that he would learn from that.
Yeah. And that's the growth part, right? That's what you got to do.
The World Juniors, we often hear that it's a tournament for the 19-year-olds more than the 18-year-olds. And in this case, when you mentioned the fact that Cole didn't have individual success in his previous World Juniors, you know, when a player does well, we'll say, well, look, it's a proof that he's the real deal, that he's ready for bigger things, that he's dominating against his peers. And when he's not doing well, we say, well, heck, the spin will be, well, it's just 5 or 6 games. It's a picture only in time, but it doesn't necessarily reveal a whole lot about the player. So in his case, how much weight did it carry for Cole Caulfield not performing in the World Juniors and determining that he was not ready to turn pro, you think?
Yeah, you know, Mark, it's interesting because, again, I've watched Cole for a long time. So I've seen him play for so many years in so many different environments, right? So people that have never seen him play have this expectation, and I get asked lots of questions. So, you know, it's interesting at the conclusion of the World Junior Tournament or even during it, I got people that have never seen him play that are seeing him play for the first time. Oh, Jesus, Cole Caulfield certainly didn't show me anything. Yeah, he might not have, but that doesn't mean he's not a good player. You know, it just means that at that particular moment in time, he wasn't ready or capable. And I think you have to factor that in. Like, what I would be really concerned, and keep in mind too, Cole Caulfield gets drafted 15th overall by the Montreal Canadiens. So everybody's tuning into the World Junior Championships and they want to watch their guy because he's their guy now. He's a Hab and they want to watch their guy. And now they're all optimistic and now they don't see that. Now they're, oh, geez, maybe we drafted the wrong guy. Maybe he's not as good as we think. And I've said this for a long time. Caulfield has been an elite goal scorer for a lot of years. And I think that, you know, 19 goals in college as a freshman speaks volumes. And I think you have to consider where people are coming from. If somebody is watching him, like I didn't leave there, and I'm not saying I'm right, but I didn't leave there thinking to myself, oh, geez, maybe Cole isn't that good of a goal scorer. I left there thinking I saw signs that he adjusted and that he became better as the tournament went on. And because of what I've seen in college this year, before the junior tournament and after the junior tournament, it just, like, my doubts, like, I didn't have any doubts. And they certainly didn't surface after the World Junior or at the World Junior because of what I'd seen and what I've seen over a long period of time.
It's funny to hear you bring up the notion of Habs fans saying, oh no, maybe we drafted the wrong guy, because we had a lot of that this season with Jesperi Kotkaniemi and the season that he had. I feel like because the NHL has become a younger league, that the attention span of fans and even media and even the general hockey world when it comes to prospects has started to get smaller and smaller, right? I mean, it's, you know, there's already people in Montreal who are saying, like, oh, quit using the age of Kotkaniemi as an excuse when he's 19 years old. He's still World Junior eligible this season. And because he's been in the picture for a year, certain things are expected that maybe 5, 6, 10 years ago, would have been ludicrous to think that Jesperi Kotkaniemi would be a 40-50 point player at age 19 in the NHL. I'm just wondering have you noticed that window becoming smaller?
Well, what I would say is, Arthon, is that, you know, our society as a whole is more impatient. You know, we want things quicker. We want things more at our fingertips. And we're not as ready to allow development and maturity to occur. And so, Jesperi Kotkaniemi in my view, a really good player. He turns 20 in July. I mean, that's how young he is. And to me, like, we just because somebody's the third overall pick, and he had a relatively good, what I would call 18-year-old season in the NHL. And, you know, now this year he ran into different challenges. But understand that the rest of the league is trying to adjust to him and trying to understand what he's doing. But just because doesn't mean that you're going to hit this peak at 20. And I think that players mature at different rates. And how many times, and again, I'm going to go, both of you know this, How many times have we seen a really good player come into the league and his second year isn't as good? We call it the sophomore jinx. What I call it is, hey, that player is still adjusting while the rest of the league, with all their experience, is understanding how to play against them because he's not new. And so, you know, I think next year will be interesting for Jesperi, but I think we, just because we've become impatient doesn't mean that development's going to change. I mean, I still know this, the gestation period from conception to birth is 9 months. You can become impatient all you want, but you know what? The baby's not going to be born at 6 months.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, I think we should make that into a poster in Montreal and just say the gestation period is 3 years for an NHL prospect. But anyhow.
So, well, I hope the fans will have their lesson with the next pick. So we talked about Kotkaniemi, who was drafted third overall. Cole Caulfield was drafted 15th. And now for the upcoming draft, the Canadiens, If things stay the way they are and they don't change spots because of the lottery, would end up either drafting eight or around the eighth spot. What sort of crop is it in this year's draft to, you know, for players who would be, let's say, in the 5 to 10 window? Because I know that there's the guys at the top of the draft seems to be, rather consensual, but, after that, there seems to be quite a few players that could be among those that could be targeted by the Canadiens at number eight. So how would you describe this?
So Mark, like, I think, like, the Montreal Canadiens, at eight, you know, I think there's real significant quality in the draft through 11, 12. Like quality. Now let me define quality. I'm going to take the goalie out. I'm going to just take a Scarif out because I see him clearly as a number one, but let's just put him on the side. I think all those players, and I'll just name Lafreniere, Stutzel, Byfield, Perfetti, Drysdale, Quinn, Rossi, Lucas Raymond, Alexander Holtz. I think they're all Drysdale, I think he's a number one defenseman. I don't label guys number one. I talk top pair, number three or number four. I think he's a number one. And I think all those forwards that I just named are all first line forwards that will produce offensively in the NHL, whether it be a center like Byfield or like Rossi or wingers like Lafreniere or Perfetti or Jack Quinn or Lucas Raymond. I think when I define quality, that's how I define it as. Like Montreal staying at eight, I see no way they can go wrong in a group of 10, 11 players where they will not get a significant player to add to their lineup.
Wow. Okay. And also I heard, among other names that, Jake Sanderson, the defenseman, was, his stock seemed to be, rising in the last couple of months. Even though I don't know if it's because scouts have been, watching more tapes of him or whatever, because obviously nobody's playing right now, but is he a guy that could sneak in the top 10 discussion?
He could, and like if somebody took him in the top 10, it wouldn't surprise me. And Jake is a terrific player. So when I talk again, so I think Jake can be a top pair. I don't see him as a number one. I see him as a Mark Edward Vlasic type player. Mm. Now Mark Edward Vlasic is a really good player and on really good teams, including Olympic teams. So, you know, but those number one defensemen are players that drive play offensively, defensively, in all areas of the game. I don't think Jake has that same offensive abilities, but if I'm getting Mark Edward Vlasic, I'm thrilled. And I think that's the type of game that Jake Sanderson has.
See, now the draft this year kind of brings me to sort of another topic that I wanted to bring up with you. You know, the Canadiens are picking eighth. They've stockpiled over the last couple of years. I think they've drafted 21 players in the last 2 years, the last two drafts, I should say. And they're reaching sort of a critical mass in terms of their prospect pool. You, when you were scouting director with the Dallas Stars, you drafted Jerome Iginla 11th overall in 1995, and the Stars traded him for Joe Nieuwendyk, which was a great move for both teams, obviously. You guys wind up with a Stanley Cup and he goes on to a Hall of Fame career in Calgary. But I'm just wondering, at that moment in time, if just to, you know, I'm not informing you of anything, but just to let our listeners know, you know, the Dallas Stars at the time, if you take players who were 25 and under on the 95-96 Stars, you had Mike Modano at 25 years old. You know, Daryl Sidorra was 23. Darian Hatcher was 23. Matt Tkachuk was 22. Lettinen was 22. You had this, Langenbrunner was 20. I mean, you had this, like, this mass of young players already. To what extent, like, what were the discussions around, you knew obviously what you had in Jerome McGinley, and you were getting obviously a Hall of Fame talent in Joe Nieuwendyk. But in terms of asset management or prospect management, is there a point where you reach a mass of talent where you're like, okay, this allows us to get creative or to explore other avenues? At what point do you reach that? And how does that discussion happen with the general manager?
Well, so there was two parts to that, Arpad. And the first part was, is we had all those young players and, uh-huh. and we had Madonna. I mean, Madonna was, yes. was a star. And yes. so, I mean, we felt so confident in him and, you know, and we had that other group and not just, I mean, we had three defensemen in Hatcher, Sidor, and Matt Tkachuk that we said they can be a real key part of our group. We, Lettinen had performed so well, you know, with Finland. We knew we had a good player there. We had lots of belief in Jamie Lagerbrother. But we came to a point where we're looking at, if we wanted to be competitive in the Western Conference, we didn't have to look very far and see Colorado with Sakic and Forsberg and Detroit with Yzerman and Fedorov for us to realize if we don't get another center with Modano, it doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter how well we draft. We have to find a way to support Modano and get another centerman in there. Now, we got the fortunate thing for us is Joe Nieuwendyk held out. So he became available. We had tried to sign a couple of free agents that we couldn't do, certainly not to the level of Joe Nieuwendyk, but, you know, that's what we were trying to do. Then it came to a point where we got serious, and Calgary was very serious about Jerome, so we knew we were in the game. Now, I will take you back to the very conversation we had, right? You know, we had essentially made up our minds that this is a move we were ready to make. But this is the one of the last conversations we had led by Bob Gainey. Bob Gainey said, listen, he goes, we know that if we want to be competitive in the Western Conference and build our team, we need a centerman to play with Mike Modano because of what I said with Sakic, Forsberg, Yzerman, and Fedorov. Joe right. Nieuwendyk fills that. He says, we also know that we have a really good young prospect in Jerome McGinley. But is he going to be able to help us and help our younger players that have gone through the trials and tribulations of growing and trying to become a good team with Jerome? Because Jerome at that time, he's 18 years old. And what Bob said is, if we get Nieuwendyk, we really can feel good about bringing in this quality of player in person to help this group. And now we can look and say, okay, how do we continue to build out our team? And we're going to be disappointed about losing a good young player like Jerome McGinley. If we don't make the trade, we're going to be disappointed and we're going to have to continue to go find ways to try to find that centerman and ask yourself, do you think there'll be another centerman like Joe Nieuwendyk in this age group come along? And legitimate question. And we'll be happy to keep Jerome McGinley. Now, as the conversation went, there was half a dozen of us on the final call, mm-hmm. and it was pretty clear. The move was pretty clear what we needed to do. And as Bob said at the end, listen, you know what? It means that we got a really good trade here. It's going to help Calgary for where they're at. It's going to help us, but it really helps both team situations. And quite frankly, like, you know, people say, oh, you gave up a good, yeah, we knew we were giving up a good young player, but we knew we were getting a really good player. And so what it came down to was Joe was going to help our young, our that group of players that you just mentioned mm-hmm. to greater significance than Jerome McGinley. And that's what ultimately I believe you have to do. Make sure that you're building your team. You don't be reckless. That wasn't a reckless trade. That was a trade that I feel it was necessary for where we were at in our evolution as a team.
Would you see a similar type of trade being done today? like considering the value that's put into prospects and first year players, etc. Is it something that could happen today?
I think so, Mark. And I think that, like, you know, again, what's going to be interesting here, like, you know, with the pandemic, is what's the NHL going to look like economically coming out of this scenario? Like, is the cap going to be held artificially high? Is that going to force teams into scenarios where, you know, they're hindered, where the cap doesn't go up? These are all questions that are going to be answered that we don't know. So, but like Joe Nieuwendyk, Calgary was in a very different place. That, you know, Joe felt that he deserved more money. They didn't feel they could pay it. The economics were different for Calgary. So Joe held out. Like, I'm not suggesting there'll be a holdout, but economics start to dictate a lot of different things. A player doesn't feel that he's getting the contract that he wants. And again, this pandemic is going to create some economic repercussions, some consequences. And I don't know what they are, but I do think that a scenario like that, now maybe it doesn't have to be a holdout, but you have to take the initiative and start to look. Hey, listen, this team might not be ready. We'll take that 26-year-old player or 27-year-old player off your team that's got a little bit of turmoil, but we still think he's good, and we'll give you a good young prospect. I think that as an organization, you have to look and consider those possibilities.
Well, okay, well, I don't think it would be a holdout either, but what is a real scenario that Marc-Antoine and I have explored recently is just the potential of not only a flat cap, but the cap actually going down. Yeah. And teams like Tampa, Toronto, I mean, there's all sorts of teams who would have to maybe part ways with players. And so the reason why I was asking you about the Aginla situation was just that, you know, the bank of prospects or young players that you guys had, you know, we've looked at sort of the Montreal situation and been like, okay, at some point, you're not going to sign all these guys. And, you know, in the last 2 years alone, there's some interest. You know, we talked about Romanov already. You know, Ullinen was about to start his pro career, his North American pro career before this pandemic hit. Jacob Olofsson, Cam Hillis, Jordan Harris, Jaden Struble, Norlander. I mean, there's just this long list of prospects. And it's at one point you got to wonder, can you monetize those guys to a certain extent and get and sort of speed up your own process in building a team?
I think you have to, Arpon. And again, you still have really good players. You have Gallagher and you have Deneau and, you know, Tatar and Weber and Price and Petrie, right? Like, so like, you know, yeah. Like how do you take those players and their abilities and reinforce it? And if you reinforce it with other players and you use young players to try to get some more experienced players, ultimately it's about making your team better. Like I don't think managers try to be reckless. I don't think sometimes things don't turn out as they expected, but I think that's the way you got to be looking all the time. And when I talk about economics, you nailed it. Flat cap, a reduced cap. What does it all mean? Because as players, are progressing up, they're going to need to get paid too. So yeah. that creates opportunities in the system as well. And, you know, one of the things that cap space gives you is if you don't have cap space, you can't even consider opportunities, the ones that are known and the ones that we don't even know yet. But when you do have cap space, you don't have to close yourself to any opportunity, known or unknown.
Well, it's all nice to say that they could use those young players as trade assets, but isn't it also a case where a team who has certain prospects, who drafted those prospects, they like them, they will probably have always more value for the team that they belong to than in the eyes of other general managers, because other teams might say, oh well, this prospect, well, there are equivalent prospects on every team. Is it, I feel like sometimes we tend to overvalue the prospects of our team or the team that we're covering in our case, but compared to what their true value would be on the market.
So Mark, what I'm going to, I'm starting to think that maybe you've been listening in to general managers' conversations. Like, that's exactly what matters. My prospect's way better than your prospect because I think organizations always are overvaluing their own players. Always. And, you know, when you see the same player and you think about prospects and, oh yeah, he's great. We drafted him. We love him and we love him. See, I think one of the key things in evaluation is recognizing when the player might have more value outside your organization and still have the luster of maybe what he could have been, and you realize that maybe he can't get there. And then that's when you start to move a player out. I think organizations fall in love with their own prospects to a far greater degree than they should.
If they lose faith too late and they're disenchanted too late, well, the trade value has gone down too. So that tipping point it's a very narrow period in time in order to pull the trigger.
You're exactly right. And that's why, you know, like you can say, you can continue on. But at some point you have to say no. Like think about I'll use an example. Think about Anthony DeAngelo. Anthony DeAngelo was drafted 19th overall by the Tampa Bay Lightning. Really good player. So he got traded. So for whatever reason, Arizona, I think they gave up a second round pick to get DeAngelo. So they're getting a 19th overall pick that they value and they move him along. Now he doesn't, for whatever reason, Arizona loses paces with him, but who's the beneficiary of him? The New York Rangers. I mean, this is a young player that's really good. And that works the other way too when you hang on to a player. So I think, Mark, it's working both ways to understand that, like, hey, I thought Arizona made a really good move trying to get DeAngelo for a second round pick. But then they weren't patient with him, and now the beneficiary is the New York Rangers, and it works exactly the same in reverse. You better be able to identify what your player is capable of doing at the NHL level and then act accordingly.
Man, just looking at that trade, the Rangers got DeAngelo and a first, which turned into Elias Anderson for Ranta and Stepan. Man, that is something. Jeez.
Anyway. Yeah, is it? Well, it really is, right? I think Anthony had 55 points or something like that this year. I'm not looking at it right now, but
53.
Yeah. So there's an example. But sometimes, I'll give you the Curtis Lazar example. Curtis Lazar, the 17th overall pick, ended up going, as you look down, he went for a second round pick to the Calgary Flames, and now he ends up being a free agent signed by the Buffalo Sabres.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the Ottawa Senators realize at an earlier point, okay, maybe Curtis Lazar is not as great as we thought, maybe he can still recoup a better return.
Yeah, I can't help but feel like the Canadians are kind of at that point right now where they have to, you know, like, I mean, I think the trade is a perfect example. Like, his highest value, well, as it turns out, it wasn't his highest value, but as soon as the draft happens, you know, these kids are all, like, they're just full of possibility, right? Like, everything is optimistic about them, and as soon as they play more, I think scouts are out there looking for warts in everyone's game. So I think, like, to Marc-Antoine's point before, like, that I feel like the Canadiens are at that point now with their last two draft classes where they should have enough information that other teams don't have on some of their guys, I don't know who, where they can decide, okay, well, we can afford to use him and him in a trade, and if that entices someone who needs financial relief and what have you. So, I mean, that's I feel like the Canadiens are at that point right now.
Yeah, and the key, and Mark and you, Arpon, both have said it, it's recognizing when the time to strike is. You know, just quickly back to the Jerome Iginla trade, you know, we make that trade right before the World Junior Tournament, and that tournament was in Boston. And we go to that tournament, there was a number of teams in on Joe Neuwendijk that didn't get him. But it was very funny, just back to the same conversation, how their prospects that they were offering were way better than Iginla. And again, it just, all it speaks to is in the eyes of those who have that player, you love your own player. But it's like high school convocation. You believe that every student is going to have success. But reality tells you all your hope doesn't mean it's going to turn into reality.
Yeah, that's true. But when Arpin was saying that he thought that the Canadians were at that point, I've got two names that I have in mind. First, I think of Ryan Poehling, who was everybody's darling following the World Juniors, well, brilliant performances there, hot player in the NCAA. And now you fast forward 12 months after, and he's had a trying debut in the AHL, trying first season. And I wonder, you know, if is this guy has lost already some of the luster of or his value in the eyes of other teams that he must have had at the time of the World Juniors. And also a guy like Jesse Hulonen, who was almost a first round pick. He was drafted very early on in the second round, blazing speed and all that. I'm curious to see if arriving in North America will let other teams think that, you know, what we perceived in that player a couple of years ago after how he played in Finland. Well, maybe he's not the kind of prospect that we thought he was. And all of a sudden that guy too, his value seems to be dropping. So I wonder specifically in those two cases, if when we talk about pulling the trigger at the right time, if it's a fitting thing for those two guys.
Well, for sure it is, Mark. And, you know, Ryan Poehling, I think Ryan Poehling's a good, solid player. I think if he can end up being like Philip Deneau, well, then you're going to be thrilled. And let's think about Philip Deneau. He was drafted in the same area of the draft. He was a first round pick by the Chicago Blackhawks that the Montreal Canadiens ended up with, right? And good on Marc Bergevin, because he was in Chicago when they drafted him and he knew the player. So, you know, somebody that looks at Ryan Poehling and understands what he is, and again, this now speaks to, you know, trying year in the American Hockey League, you know, growing and everything that goes with it. But another team goes, hey, wait a sec, that guy's good, but he's not MVP World Junior caliber, like in terms of NHL, he's this player, and now can you get him for less than the price? And I think for any team, you're trying to identify who those players are that you pay a little bit less to acquire. And conversely, for the team that has them, trying to make sure that you're not selling them or trading them at a discount. That's the key. You don't want to trade players at a discount.
No, for sure.
This is why I say the Canadians are at that point, is that you don't want to allow these guys to become a discounted thing and have that possibility, still have weight in certain trade talks. Well, listen, Craig, this has been a fantastic conversation. We're gonna wrap it up just cause it's been great. And I want to free you up to look longingly at the ski hills and not be able to go. So, thank you so much for joining us, Craig. It's been great.
Oh, it was.
Hey, listen. You know, listening to you at the beginning, you know, Mark, you were talking about taking your daughter past Arpad's house and showing her where he lives, right? I think one of the things we miss is being around everybody. And you guys were going to be out on the California trip with the Canadians. Yep. I was going to be out too. I always enjoy seeing you guys. I always enjoy chatting with you. So I miss that. I look forward to the next time we can do it. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for accepting our invitation, and thank you everybody for listening to The Athletic Support. We'll be back next week, next Friday, for the French edition of Le Super Athletic. Thank you everybody, and see you, Arpin.
Take care, everyone.